which brings you programs by Associated Breeders Poodles every week from Monday to Friday.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is pretty much the air of anticipation that would have been the case if you were one of those wonderful, bright, sparkling families in the 1950s and you fancied investing in this wonderful thing called commercial television, or actually watching what commercial television would actually be about. Television was not 24/7, it was not on demand, it was pre-Amazon Prime, Netflix, and other aspects of the multi-screen world in which we live in the 21st century. In 1955, this was big news because it was the second broadcasting service for television that the country had ever actually known. It was also the first commercial television service that was actually there. And as I said, it wasn't 24/7. Effectively, you would have had a test card and then an announcement and a build-up, and a kind of medley of a mixture of patriotic tunes would be used to effectively set the scene for the evening's entertainment, which would probably last until pretty much midnight, at which point the national anthem would be played and Britain would effectively go to bed. So how did we actually get here, and how are we going to actually talk through this whole process in terms of the system of television, which is very much what this focus, or at least the first hour, is going to be about before we open up in terms of presentations? Well, kind of all goes back to the days of the essence of course, the establishment, and indeed this particular base here in terms of Broadcasting House. And television actually in Britain started in the 1930s. Actually, television was known about actually at the start of the 20th century. There was a demonstration of World's Fair at Paris to actually show that visual images could be transmitted just as radio waves could be transmitted. But it was one of those things which effectively people weren't quite sure how to deal with, what it was about, and so on. In fact, if you look at the advertisements in the 1920s for these televisors, the format that television was taking was very similar to Skype. It was not seen as a broadcast medium. It was seen as a medium in which individuals could connect with each other over long distances. 1930, Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald received as a gift from John Logie Baird the first ever television receiver set. Absolutely pointless because there weren't any programmes on, but it was still there after a fashion. And in his own words, he noted that it could have huge impacts in terms of the way in which the empire could be governed. And bear in mind, in the 1930s, Britain still had an empire. We hadn't actually had the Second World War, we certainly hadn't had India declaring independence, and so on and so forth. So again, brief history. I'm sure this is kind of going over old ground in one or two instances. The BBC was established initially in 1922 as the British Broadcasting Company. It existed as that for 5 years until it became the British Broadcasting Corporation in 1927. And the first ever Director General of the BBC was John Reith, who of course coined the phrase to inform, to educate and to entertain. And there he is, right in the middle of that little number there. Again, it's not a personal issue, but Reith was very much an individual who did it his way. He saw television as an evangelical medium to actually produce the best of a nation's output and so on. And you might say he could certainly have subscribed to what we now refer to as the high and low culture debate. The classic line about Reith was that, in the words of Asa Briggs, the historian, you either did it his way or the highway, and you would be exiled to the regions. And actually, Reith was very much responsible for centering broadcasting in Britain, in London, as opposed to Leicester, as opposed to Newcastle, Birmingham, Manchester, Edinburgh, and so on. So the BBC effectively had a monopoly, in essence. And although they experimented with television signals in the 1930s, very much with Alexander Palace, and they had television programmes, it's none clear in terms of what Reith's position was on television. He was very much a radio man. His daughter at one stage kind of claimed that he had been painted as being anti-television. That's not necessarily the case, but he did feel as though certainly the test transmissions, which led to Marconi's system of 625 lines being adopted as opposed to John Logie Baird's, he was not particularly impressed with the programme that was put together. And if you look back over the radio times of the period and you look back at what archive footage remains of the television recordings that were produced, you see things such as gardening shows, household tips, how to build a bomb shelter, fashion, entertainment, and so on. With the exception of how to build a bomb shelter, probably most of the others kind of still resonate in one way, shape, or form with shows such as Flog It, or indeed any of the reality TV shows, which seems to suggest that unless you're actually a world champion in sewing or dancing and singing or all three, then effectively your life is over. As a broadcasting system, and this is obviously not about radio because that'll be talked about in a couple of weeks' time, the BBC was very much at the centre of the way in which families would actually receive their information. And actually, until television, radio was the fastest growing technological medium that developed. Alexander Palace, as I mentioned, was the key base which was used to promote and produce the early television programmes. And it's interesting that most of the people who actually worked for the BBC in television during the war effectively left to work and develop radar. Television was actually suspended during the war years. In fact, when war was declared, the BBC effectively ceased transmission shortly afterwards because it was suggested that actually the television signals could actually act as a homing beacon for Nazi bombers and aircraft to effectively target systems and so on. So we see that television was kind of gradually developing in the pre-war years. It was under the auspices of the BBC, and the apocryphal tale is that television was suspended, transmissions were suspended in 1939, halfway through a Walt Disney cartoon, a Mickey Mouse cartoon, and picked up again in 1946, pretty much shortly afterwards, with a slight interruption, obviously. So where does that take us? Well, the thing about television in its early years, and we're talking about the 30s, 40s, 50s, it was a very cumbersome medium, and it required an awful lot of an infrastructure. It needed the equivalent of an Alexander Palace. It needed studios which had high ceilings to enable lighting to effectively be set up. You effectively had control rooms for sound and various other elements within that whole field. So it was a clunky medium, but it was one which was clearly growing and developing as the technology developed. Remember that phrase, technological determinism. You look at the kind of technology society, you look at how things develop, you look at how to see the things sort of improve and so on. You know, these days you can produce your own TV programs on your mobile phone, after a fashion. But again, the format that you're looking at in terms of newsreaders perched on desks, sitting behind desks, addressing camera, the one-to-one relationship was very much there. One of the early criticisms of television was that it was simply radio with pictures. And actually that's understandable, because actually radio was a medium that the BBC was used to working with. Why should it actually change its format and so on? This is obviously pre-ITV, pre-commercial television and so on. And that does have an impact in the same way as Sky and Netflix and Google all have had impacts in terms of public service broadcasting and so on. And there is probably the key point in history in which we actually say things began to change as far as television was concerned. The coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, 1953. And that whole essence of being able to have pictures, moving pictures, beamed from the actual service itself to individuals' households and homes was very much not only a driver in terms of getting more people to buy television sets, but it also kind of raised the whole profile of television as a separate medium in its own right. We talk about comparative media histories. This was the moment where, although Richard Dimbleby, one of the early commentators, indeed father of David Dimbleby and Jonathan Dimbleby, was very much at the heart of these whole projects, etc., we're seeing the beginning of the growth of what we now understand as the mass televisual medium. But as I say, interludes are always nice to just sort of set things along their own way. And the classic sort of interlude, whether it be the potter's wheel, whether it actually be the windmill, or any of the other areas, was very much at this part of broadcasting, which probably is it unrecognisable from what we have today? In some instances, yes. Because again, it's not a all-day-long phenomenon. It's something which basically is, just like radio in its early days, restricted to certain parts of the day. And interludes would actually come on board, for instance, when children should be put to bed, which is basically before 6 o'clock. And then afterwards, obviously, you come back for the news and various other things. It's kind of where the whole notion of the 9 o'clock watershed emerged in the 1960s. Clearly these days, although technically it's still in existence, actually the 9 o'clock watershed is effectively meaningless because you can download stuff pretty much as and whenever, not without worrying necessarily about audiences and so on. Television celebrities, people who would endorse things, people who you would trust, journalists whose voices and faces you would trust, just as we would trust Kirsty Walk, Jeremy Paxman, Dan Snow, other sort of folk, all begin to develop at this particular time. Because again, they have that voice of authority. Whether they're commentating on things or whether they're addressing particular issues, again, from the point of view of the news and the happenings of the day. Whether that happens to be the Suez Canal crisis, whether it happens to be who's winning the various football matches of the day, any of those sort of factors, television is beginning to bring it home to people's lives and so on. This is an example of the potter's wheel and the interlude that you'd actually get. Why have we already heard that? How bizarre. Okay, let's move on. As we said, with respect to rediffusion, commercial television appeared a lot sooner than commercial radio, actually 20 years sooner. And it was very much driven by the basis of the notion that somehow television could be commercialised. Well, actually, it wasn't so much a gamble, because it already had been commercialised hugely in the United States. You know, Britain, America hadn't shut down its TV services, it had actually developed them and grown them and brought a whole range of packages together. And in the added notion that in the States, with ABC, NBC and CBS, you had three networks which were also producing programming. Why? Because they've got Hollywood and various TV studios and production bases in their backyards as well. So they've already got a film industry. So this whole notion of movies, film industries, etc. And yes, there's a certain tension between television and the cinema. But what does cinema do to react to television? It makes things bright, bolder, bigger, in colour, with 3D, whole cinematic experiences. Again, you find this time and time again, that just as recently we've been looking at surveys that suggest that people who actually subscribe to Netflix or Amazon Prime, hands up if you subscribe to either or both. Also, we'll go and see movies in cinemas as well. So there's all the connection with respect to that that works through that whole process in terms of what we're seeing. But this one is the first ever commercial that was featured, the first ever broadcast of commercial television when it launched.
It's tingling fresh. It's fresh as ice. It's Gibbs SR toothpaste. The tingling fresh toothpaste that does your gums good too. The tingle you get when you brush with SR is much more than a nice taste. It's a tingle of health. It tells you something very important. That you're doing your gums good and toughening them to resist infection. And as this chart shows, gum infection is the cause of more tooth losses than decay itself. The tingling SR comes from sodium resinoate, a substance which both dental research and years of use in dental practice have shown to be good for the gums. So, to keep your teeth white as snow, your gums really healthy, and your breath really fresh, see your dentist regularly and brush with SR, the tingling fresh toothpaste for teeth and gums. Gibbs SR.
And if you look at that, there are very, very few differences if you look pound for pound, apart from the colour the sound and various other bits and pieces between what we're seeing there and what any other toothpaste advert of yesterday would actually show you in terms of what today tuned into, you know, commercials, etc. Or it might well be, of course, because you subscribe to Netflix or Amazon Prime, I can't do doing with commercials. Dreadful. But this is a time where basically if you wanted to have commercial television, unless you went and made a coffee or something, the commercials are very much embedded into that. Key thing that I want to stress here, again, beyond the podcast as well, but it's worthwhile noting, it's an old line I keep coming back to, and it applies to commercial radio and commercial television. Commercial television is not necessarily in the business of making programs, it's in the business of delivering audiences to advertisers. The business of delivering audiences to advertisers. So that as popular programs develop, so advertising rates can go up, so television companies can actually charge advertisers more, whether they are toothpaste advertisers, whether they are cigarette advertisers, back in the 50s, 60s, etc., alcohol, any of those things are part and parcel of that way in which commercial television works. So you could argue, as many people did, I never watch the BBC, I only watch commercial television, therefore I shouldn't have to pay my licence fee. Actually, that's never really quite so. I think there's only been one case where somebody actually proved that because of their aerial they could only receive commercial television, so they kind of didn't have to pay the licence fee. But in the same way as the loophole recently about if you only watch programmes via the BBC iPlayer or online, you didn't have to pay a licence. That's also sort of been squeezed out of the systems as well. Darn it, the system always crushes the individual. What's happened to freedom and so on? What was the impact of commercial television on the BBC? Well, it was pretty impressive on a number of accounts. I mean, first of all, the BBC on the opening night of ITV attempted to actually spoil audiences by running on their radio broadcasts for the light programme, The Tragic Death of Grace Archer, which was basically a very popular soap opera character in terms of the Archers. And this was one where basically the gamble was that people would be so committed to actually listening to radio, they wouldn't worry about having to tune into this upstart independent television company and so on. Also, we see a change in the variety of programmes that are being made. We see the BBC in the same way as ITV beginning to take ideas from America, beginning to look at things, as you can see there with Nigel Neal's Quatermass, at genre programming like science fiction, in addition to other sort of areas to popularise things, to develop things, etc. And again, we're seeing echoes of this now. You know, you look at the number of science fiction themed shows on Netflix, on Amazon Prime, soon to be on Disney. You know, this is one of the driving forces. I mean, it was often said that you got three guarantees you want to make a million in terms of broadcasting: sex, soccer, science fiction, or sex, sport, and science fiction. Obviously, one of those is pornographic, still works, I wouldn't advise it, but it's there. You've also got, obviously, the other two things which are legal and effectively can impact in terms of where people are actually going for, drivers, as they're called, in terms of who's going to be watching these particular shows and so on. And who's going to impact this American-based shows, which also play around with British themes such as this, which is an awesome theme, which I guarantee you'll be humming throughout the course of the day, even during your presentations. Ignore the Teletubbies, but the next one is good. Here it is.
Robin Hood, Robin Hood, riding through the glen. Robin Hood, Robin Hood, with his band of men. Feared by the bad, loved by the good. Robin Hood, Robin Hood, Robin Hood. He called the bravest archers to a tavern on the green. They vowed to help the people of the king. They handled all the trouble on the English country scene, and still found plenty of time to sing. Robin Hood, Robin Hood, riding through the glen. Robin Hood.
Okay, I think we've got the gist of the whole thing. Robin Hood is an interesting example because screenwriters for Robin Hood, which was one of the ITC series, independent television, ITC, independent television company, the screenwriters had kind of moved back to Britain or migrated to Britain from Hollywood because of the McCarthy witch hunts. There was an awful lot of issues in the 1950s with respect to Senator Joe McCartney and the House Un-American Activities Commission, in which people in Hollywood, screenwriters, actors, producers, directors, were actively encouraged to report any of their colleagues who they deemed might have had left-wing, socialist or commie-leaning influences. And rather than actually put up with that, you found that a number of very talented screenwriters said, we've had enough of this, we're leaving the country, we're going over to Britain. And obviously the then fledgling commercial television sector in Britain, and the BBC to a certain extent, took these folk on board and enabled them to actually develop their skills even further. And their skills were already pretty highly developed, finely tuned. You're writing good programming, good characters, good plot development, etc., all can kind of impact in terms of what people work through. And so you get for a time this period that's referred to pretty much from the late 1950s to arguably the mid-1980s of a golden age of television, an age that we still look back to fondly with nostalgia and remake programmes and develop various other bits and pieces. A series of programmes which will move from the situation comedy of Hancock's Half Hour, Tony Hancock and Sid James and so on, right the way through a mixture of a variety of other sort of aspects as well. A little clip of Hancock in line for this. Again, ATV, commercial television, from the Midlands. This is probably the equivalent, in generic terms, of Alan Partridge and This Time. Anybody seen the Alan Partridge series as yet? What have you been doing? Check it out on iPlayer. See a whole range of things with that point of view. Or indeed, basically, situation comedies, and you get a range of different generic forms opening up. You also get a variety of other imports that are being used. Because McCarthy wasn't going to go on forever. And clearly, by the time we reached the launch of The Twilight Zone in 1959, he'd actually moved on, and American television was continuing to grow and develop. But it still had challenges. The creator of The Twilight Zone, Rod Serling, was a television writer who wanted to write, quote-unquote, serious television drama. He produced a drama based on the Holocaust, but the sponsor of the time actually refused to allow him to mention anything to do with gas ovens because the sponsor was American Electric, General Electric. And obviously they made gas ovens, and you can't have people associating, you know, obviously the horror of the Holocaust with a brand product that's being advertised. It doesn't work on a number of reasons. Basically, it's subtle, or maybe not so subtle, censorship. And so Serling, together with a number of writers, turns to science fiction as a mode of actually beginning to express ideas as an allegory, as a parody, as a metaphor for things that they felt were important to comment on. And television at this stage is a hugely influential medium. It's a way in which the whole family are kind of getting a whole variety of elements in that. Whether it's the reinforcement of family values as portrayed in westerns like Bonanza, whether it's a case of American cop series, whether it's a case of science fiction series, there are ways in which this is beginning to influence people. It's also quite interesting from the point of view of representation, because we often think we never had any diversification in the 60s. Actually, that's wrong. A number of series I'll show you in a few seconds which kind of made great steps to develop that. And The Twilight Zone was used again to comment on society issues in the same way as Black Mirror does, with respect to, obviously, in the case of Black Mirror, Charlie Borman effectively... Who's the Black Mirror person? Remind me, who looks after Black Mirror? Charlie Brooker, thank you, yes, that's right. Charlie Borman is an actor. Charlie Brooker sort of will comment on, again, the sort of ways or misuses of social media and so on. This, again, opens up The Twilight Zone.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
And again, these things kind of continue to develop and get repeated, repackaged, and have a longevity. The latest series of The Twilight Zone is being developed by Jordan Peele, who had an Academy Award winner last year with Get Out. If you saw the movie, again, he's developing sort of various other aspects with respect to this. Outer Limits, likewise, was using the whole notion of the Monster of the Week and elements with respect to that. Again, you can look at that. And the reason I'm covering the American show is this is a period where one of the differences between the BBC and ITV is the ITV are using many more American imports. So you've got a cultural issue there. Now, why are they using American imports? Well, when you share the same language, English, be it American English or Estuary English, why should you bother shelling out for programmes that you have to make from scratch when you've already got a ready-made selection that you can simply import in en masse? Obviously, there are global markets, but you don't have to have any hassles with respect to subtitles or various other bits and pieces. And in fact, it's not really until the 1960s that Britain starts exporting product made in Britain back to America. Obviously led, as we've said in the past, by bands such as the Beatles from a popular cultural aspect, but also echoing from that point of view, James Bond, co-produced films, etc., and from television, the numerous iterations that were spy-fi in action and so on, again, another genre that was being developed and so on. Gerry Anderson also led the way. Pop quiz question for you. What was the first ever television programme made in colour in the United Kingdom? Actually, long before people had colour televisions, because the series actually ran in 1963-64, but colour television didn't really emerge until 67-68. But it was made in colour specifically because it was being beamed at the American market, who had had colour televisions since the 1950s. Any ideas? Major clue? Anything can happen in the next half hour. Spot on. Well done, sir. He shoots, he scores. I would have been so sad if you hadn't gotten that. And here it is.
Stand by for action. We are about to launch Stingray.
So you got everything a young child viewer could actually wish for. You got colour, you got bonus, you got action adventure, you got a very, very dynamic opening credit sequence is actually there. And you've got, in the case of Marineville, something which I honestly believe heavily influenced the design of Minerva in terms of various other bits and pieces. I'm convinced of that. Will ever remain so. Likewise, Westerns. You know, very popular as a generic form, very good family viewing, opening up a whole range of things there, whether it be Gunsmoke, whether it be Bonanza, whether it be the Wild Wild West, any of these things. We're seeing a whole range of different sort of aspects, which are all populist programming. And the BBC responds to that by, again, looking to develop, and in some cases, in the case of Sidney Newman, actually bringing on board people who'd worked to develop series like the Avengers, not the Marvel Comics universe ones, but the original Avengers, to work with them, and so on and so forth. I mentioned James Bond for a specific reason, because culturally in the 60s, you've got the Cold War. You've got lots of things happening. You've got President Kennedy, who was obviously assassinated, but he maintained his favourite book was Casino Royale. He was very much into spy-fi. This particular sort of excerpt is the first case of, again, how television is using to start addressing issues. Has anybody got any familiarity at all with The Man from U.N.C.L.E.? Okay. U.N.C.L.E. is an acronym which stands for United Network, Command for Law and Enforcement. Its two lead characters were... Look, it's Ducky from NCIS, but specifically David McCallum as Ilya Kuryakin, and Robert Vaughan as Napoleon Solo. This was a primetime TV series in which you actually had a Russian secret agent, or a Russian-born soul, working with an American kind of Kennedy-esque person over, obviously, a whole range of diabolical schemes put together by an organisation called Thrush, which the writers had lots of fun in a variety of different ways, etc. I think it actually stands for Technological Hierarchy for Revenge and Supremacy of Humanity, something along those sort of lines, although it was never effectively done. Anyway, let's have a listen to this opening sequence. Started in black and white, and then went into colour.
In New York City. On a street in the East 40s, there's an ordinary tailor shop. Or is it ordinary? We entered through the agent's entrance, and we are now in UMCLE headquarters. That's the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement. U.N.C.L.E. is an organization consisting of agents of all nationalities. It's involved in maintaining political and legal order anywhere in the world.
My name is Napoleon Solo. I'm an enforcement agent in Section 2 here. That's operations and enforcement.
I am Ilya Kuryakin. I'm also an enforcement agent. Like my friend Napoleon, I go and I do whatever I am told to by our chief.
Oh, yes. Alexander Waverly, number one in Section 1, in charge of this, our New York headquarters. It's from here that I send these young men on their various missions.
And so it goes. So you may recall Guy Ritchie had a movie called Man from U.N.C.L.E., which was a remake of this a few years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago, starring Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer. Didn't quite take off, but again, iterations developed. Maybe, as I say, it was of its time and worked on that basis. I Spy took things a little bit further, starring the now, sadly, defrocked, you might say, Bill Cosby, who's had all sorts of problems, and the late Robert Culp. But this was a primetime spy programme which actually had Robert Culp as a tennis player / CIA agent, and his tennis coach and partner, Bill Cosby, who also effectively worked for the CIA from that point of view. I'll give you just a few seconds to give a sense of this as well.
Grateful. Who wrote this thing, huh? Come on. Look, I don't know anything about grateful. I'm here because I'm the best, see? And because I work like a slave, if you'll pardon the expression, to get that way. Grateful to who? I'm grateful to me. Anyway, after much soul searching, I've decided I will not return to the United States, but I'll make my new home from this day forward with my new friends in the People's Republic of China.
If you wish, you can actually see full whole episodes of I Spy and various other things on YouTube and so on. Now, that's not to say that television drama wasn't obviously undergoing a sort of halcyon treatment here as well, because the classics were still being developed, BBC was still doing Shakespearean plays and so on, and we also had a variety of game shows as well, many of which used formats which had been established in the United States. Game shows, again, cheap, easy, quick to put together, and popular. Again, that notion, as I said a few moments ago, delivering audiences to advertisers. Interestingly enough, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was first screened in Britain on BBC. Likewise, Star Trek, another series which is often sort of flagged as being a groundbreaker in terms of images and lines that are coming through. But just to show that actually trash television hasn't just originated in the last 10 or 15 years... motive behind the Gong Show was the entertainer, whether they were a crazy dancer, a singer, a comedian, effectively were allowed to perform until effectively the gong, which you saw in the background, was effectively hit, and the entertainer or the performer had to come off and so on. Again, not too dissimilar to spinning chairs around and various other bits and pieces. So you've got in this particular period, again, partly a golden age, partly a range of other factors. As I mentioned, colour television came to Britain in the 1960s. So did a third television channel. And again, this was the BBC. It was BBC Two, which emerged in 1964. Again, to open up ostensibly a more intellectual approach to television, because there is this concern that if all you're getting through, in the words of what Harlan Ellison, the writer, would say, is a cathode ray teat, or cathode ray tube teat, if all you're sucking from that piece of technology is trash, or what's perceived as trash, then that's not really a healthy sign for society, is it? So what about some of the great thinkers? What about the aspects of television? Things like Bronowski's Ascent of Man, things like David Attenborough's Life on Earth, Jonathan Miller's Area. Or do we actually, effectively say, the heck with that, ultimately what we really want are more superheroes?
Warning all of you to brace yourselves for big news. The biggest. Tell them, Robin. totally surprised us, Batman. It's really exciting. Soon, very soon, Batman and I will be battle-pulking right out of your TV sets and onto your theater screens.
That's right, Robin. Our first full-length motion picture feature in color opens a whole new world of thrills.
Which in many ways you could argue was the first template before Superman in 1978, before the whole Marvel Universe, etc., for what has become obviously a plethora of superhero movies. All looking forward to Captain Marvel, who opens this Friday? Okay. It's big business though, you can't deny that. Likewise, again, I talked about ITZ. Roger Moore, known to many as Bond and various other bits and pieces, was, apart from Ivanhoe and Maverick, also cutting his teeth in various other projects like The Saint, which was based on the Leslie Charteris novels. And you get a whole range of these things working, which, in a sense, are classics. They stand the test of time up to a point. They can look dated. They certainly provide a window opportunity into the times themselves and the aspects of that. But it's also, given that Britain is exporting these over to America, you're getting that cultural exchange, which suggests, in many ways, at the time, Britain's British television was one of the finest in the world.
Please die. I should know the name of the man to whom I owe my life.
You mean you don't? Your Majesty, may I present the infamous Simon Templar?
Arguably, in the case of pop eating itself, you still can access these things via ITV4, via channels, and again, they haven't gone away. One of the things the BBC probably deeply regrets is they actually destroyed a large number of their shows between 1955 through to the mid-1970s, because they thought nobody's going to watch this anymore. It's ephemeral. It's junk. It's useless. So actually come the time where obviously video in the 1980s, DVDs later on, and obviously online streaming, etc. I mean, interesting enough, the recent combination channel that's being put forward is BritBox. Have you heard of BritBox? A combination of ITV, Channel 4 and BBC looking to provide an answer to Netflix by using an awful lot of archive material, archive content, and producing that kind of subscriber-led programming. Which clearly will feature an awful lot of the elements of things that we've looked at today. You'd have Kafkaesque series like The Prison with Patrick McGoohan, 17 episodes, which effectively were commissioned on the basis of Lou Grade, then in charge of the independent television company, saying, I have no idea what it's about, but what the hey, we'll commission it, run with it, on the back of the success that Patrick McGoohan had actually had with Danger Man and so on. So lots and lots of key things working there, and a period of time where, as I say, three major television channels, the fourth would not emerge until 1982, Channel 4, and the fifth and last terrestrial-based channel, Channel 5, which actually was a quiz question that I noticed in private eye, that a question had been put to the contestant. I can't remember what series it was, but I think it was Tipping Point or something. What was the fifth television channel to be broadcast in the United Kingdom, and the answer of the contestant, Channel 4. Anyway, obviously not a Lincoln graduate. Again, situation comedies reflecting society, very much to the fore there. Sidney Newman, we'd already looked at him in times past, the creator of Doctor Who, amongst other things, The Avengers and so on, and drama documentaries, plays which are really reflecting the harsh end of society. Some might say a mixture of drama documentaries and the essence of kitchen sink drama. We talked again, Cole, back in the days, those of you who did Origins of Modern Britain with me, about the whole notion of the angry young men. And whilst they were never significantly popular in movies, such as Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Look Back in Anger, they did actually emerge very much as a strong player in television productions, ranging from original soap operas such as Coronation Street, Right the Way Onwards. Mentioning Mary Whitehouse because, again, this was very much part of the reason the 9 o'clock watershed was established. The essence of, if television is seen as an all-pervasive medium, if it's seen as a medium which is hugely influential because of the kind of millions of people who are watching this, and this is an era where, for instance, Mork and Wise, Christmas special, you're getting upwards of 17, 18 million people watching it. Talking big numbers here, long before multi-platform television and multi-channel television kind of emerged. Then the sense that somehow these are influential aspects needed to be developed, and certainly issues related to the National Viewers and Listeners Association, in which there was a pressure group developed to actually ensure that what was being screened was not offensive, that it didn't actually sort of relate to issues that were causing problems and challenges from that point of view. Whether they were police or drama series, or whether they were effectively documentaries and so on. Interesting enough, this particular series, which has been revamped and repackaged, you may be familiar with the new Sky version of the whole thing, came under an awful lot of flack at the time. I don't think it actually is functioning now, it's out there. But Hawaii Five-O, it was, for one stage, the longest running American TV series. It lasted for 12 seasons. That's since been surpassed in a whole range of ways. But ever-presence that we see on a regular basis emerging, such as police series, hospital series. Anybody seen the Holby City? Any Holby City or Casualty fans here? No? You see, this is a generation that's not there. Which, again, is one of those areas where I think is television. It's not, I don't think it's ever going to return to the golden age that I mentioned between the late 50s to the mid-1980s. But I think it's kind of carving its own line in terms of product that has been developed and so on. Hill Street Blues, I'm just using this as an example because it was an ensemble piece of writing that was fated very much in the 1980s as a new realistic form of police drama, set obviously in New York and focusing obviously on the classic line, "Be careful out there." You could argue it's a far cry from the kind of glitz and glamour and apparent sort of untouchable world of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and so on, but it's still producing a whole variety of other aspects, just as arguably series such as Big Bang Theory, Friends, of course, other sort of areas will develop their own particular followings. Interesting, most of those are American-based series. British equivalents, such as Cold Feet, which is probably the closest thing we've actually had to Friends, it's never quite taken off. Any Cold Feet fans here? Any Friends fans here? Anybody remember Friends? So again. So lots of crossovers, lots of what we would refer to as intertextual or genre hybridization. And ultimately, that whole line about saying, well, how shocking that the BBC should actually incorporate a female character as the lead of Doctor Who. Are you a social justice warrior? No. But in terms of the aspects that we're actually seeing, it's part and parcel of the way that television reflects society, it has its own position to play within society. And in terms of the media side of things, the reason I focus primarily on cultural products today is it gives you a good chance to have a snapshot of how things have developed pretty much over the last 70 or so years that the cathode ray tube has been developing its own sort of system. Of course, we moved into a multi-platform environment. Next week, for the lecture slot, we'll talk about, again, that other key element when it comes to television, the crossover and multi-platform nature, in which it's not good enough for Doctor Who to just be a popular television programme. It needs to be developed via catch-up so you can watch it again. You need to have your associated books, narratives, multi-platform things. We talk about the phenomenon known as transmedia storytelling. Transmedia storytelling, which probably is reaching its peak with respect to the Marvel Comics universe and so on, as just one example, but there are lots of other areas that come into place as well. Has anybody got any questions?